I would like to... Is the microphone working all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I would like to speak this morning on, first, on two aspects in my sound work and how I feel that today's programmable technology really it affects and advances this kind of work. The first is maybe the simplest to explain, and that has to do with the structure of music over time. And it became very interesting to me when I began my first work, which was in 1967, actually. I began working with telecommunications resources. And at this time, I created a piece for an FM radio station in Buffalo, New York. Perhaps you know of the Center for the Creative and Performing Arts. Was an organization that invited various guest composers from all over the world. It was very active for a while. So I was one of them, and at that time, I installed microphones in 8 different remote locations in the area. And then 15,000 hertz dedicated telephone lines to the microphones. And the sound came live to the radio station for a 28-hour broadcast where I was mixing these various remote sources. And the sound for this particular production was close-mic'd. The microphones were close to the sound sources, and they were different in environments in the local Buffalo area. And after that, I became very interested in using this technology to make deeper studies in my studio. I was at MIT for a period of time, for a period of 4 years, at the Center for Advanced Visual Studies. And while I was there, I installed a microphone at the Boston Harbor. And for me, this was a really wonderful resource for studio studies. The microphone was connected to my studio, again with a dedicated high quality radio telephone line for approximately 3 years. And it came into my mixing board, and I could walk into my room, and particularly late at night was when I was most interested, after midnight, 12 o'clock, when things really quieted down. And I could then begin to absorb. It was one factor of living with this live sound like this, almost the way you would turn on your radio or turn on records. I was able to live with this, but what was important to me is that I really learned what interested me, and I had no way to learn this in music. I learned about spatial perception and spatial dimension in sound. I could hear sound very far away and close up, things disappearing and appearing. And these are factors in my music and when I began that interested me, but in our traditional musical presentations, usually everything is on a stage or in one place. So it wasn't that I wanted the sounds of birds or the sounds of the harbor or any of these sounds. I really wanted much more to experience and learn about hearing and how, so that I could make an interval or I could make an instrument in my music that perhaps had some kind of similarity to the dimensions that we actually hear in life. And I think it's one extension when John Cage talked about the sounds around us, my interest is much more in how we as human perceivers are experiencing these sounds, and that's really what's in the environment for me that interested me. And as I said, I'm not so interested in the sounds themselves. So with this same installation in my studio that I could make these studies and observe things, I could also use this live sound from the harbor in other shows and other installations in other cities. While this was installed, I did another radio production for WBAI in New York, where the sound from Boston and the sound from the New York Harbor were then sent to Radio Music France. And this was a half-hour live broadcast. And I made a variety of different installations with this, and that, to me, is very convenient. I think it's a nice thing. It's like the fax machine now. You just hook up a telephone line, the sound comes into your studio, you go to Australia, you know, all you need is the money to rent the line to bring this other environment or this other world, whatever it is that you would like to your performing situation. So in this period of time, I made some 21 of these different installations of live sound in different places, in museums, and in radio stations. But I think the most valuable thing to me about it were really these. Of course, it's always nice to have in a performance, but it was really these situations in my studio, both in Boston and in New York, when I had the sound coming in and I could analyze it and experience it and learn about dimension in sound. So after this period of work, I began, then as the computer programs became more possible, and we now have them in the world, and it also makes things much easier for us. It affected my thinking about structure, and I described these environmental works in order to give you some background to how I think about musical structure now. It became important to me. In my installations and performances, I've tried to stage the sound whenever I can architecturally. And the idea of that is getting the sound to circulate in the structure of the room, within the building. And often I like to make works that involve more than one room. And these works are called Music for Sound Joined Rooms. And in these instances, I will have several rooms and I will install the sound. And it's what acousticians refer to as structure-borne sound when that happens, which is interesting to me, because if you play two speakers in a room and you're playing the tone middle C and the sound goes directly out into air, the middle C, the wavelength for middle C is 4 feet 4 inches, you know, about this big. If it's traveling through the wood or a stone also, the speed of sound is much faster. So that same middle C is no longer 4 feet in wavelength. It is actually 19 feet. And the wave is much larger. And of course, as the sounds get lower, they are even much larger than that. And intuitively, I didn't realize this in the beginning, I just staged my sound this way because I preferred hearing it than having it in the room directly in air. And later, I realized this factor, and it makes quite a difference, I think, in experiencing music. So as a result of these architectural stagings, in which I have staged the music as much as possible structurally and made sets, I realized as a result of present-day technology something quite interesting, that really in a few years, I mean, right now we have samplers that can do everything, but in an... Well, probably in a matter of 2 years, there'll be very good variation makers. So what that means is really, it can take my music, a variation maker, and perhaps in a few years later, people will have in their homes these same variation makers, and a very extended program will be available to make quite wonderful variations of everyone's music. And it will be very simple. So where does that leave someone who's actually seriously working in the profession of music if this becomes so available and so possible? So then to resolve this problem, I think that the whole idea of structure of music over time, or the flow, or the distribution of worlds, or changes of sound becomes very important, because that's a more difficult thing to actually design a little program for. Someone has to really, beforehand, imagine it. Perhaps eventually very interesting knowledge will develop about creating changes in creating worlds, maybe somewhere in the late 1990s. But right now, it doesn't exist. You can take any form of minimal music. I mean, it's nothing to just sample this, and it will be not difficult to make any variation. So if you're actually making something, I don't know, there's just not much point unless maybe you're doing something that takes 3 weeks before a new software can actually be invented to make a variation or duplicate your work. So because of this factor, I then became interested in making what I call dramatic forms in space, in which there are extreme changes through the structure in time. And this description relates to the work that I'm presenting here, which I call a mini sound series. And I adapted this idea from television and from comic books, because I think the form is really very interesting, and I think it's unfortunate that we exist in the world and in whatever our musical tradition is, and the idea is you go in one night and you do a performance and you leave, and people get like it and get excited, or they hate it, or whatever, and this is the way it goes. But on the other hand, television and comic books have something that's very involving. The stories continue, the music continues, and I didn't realize all this when I began. My first mini sound series was in San Francisco, and it was a 6-part, and it was distributed over 6 weeks, which for me I think is the most interesting way of presenting these works, because people hear them, they go away. If they want to come back, they tell other people. A real kind of dialogue gets set up. It's as though you become interested in a story on television and you look at it next week, or you don't. My experience, it was a wonderful relationship with the audience in almost every one of these I've done, that if I'd come to this situation and had done two separate concerts, it would not, I don't think it would have, for me, I don't think it would have been as meaningful as this idea that you leave, and even though the piece isn't continuing, audibly, it still exists. And my reason for I chose also to do this because I was interested in a form that was not a continuous installation, which of course we have now very many in the world, continuous sound installations, sound art, nor a conventional concert format. So with the mini sound series, I'm able to make something that does evolve over time, and I'm able to make a story, and I'm able to explore these dramatic changes of music over time that I spoke of earlier, that I think because of to me becomes important because of existing technology, and because someone's going to make a software to make a variation of my music in a few days. And so I would like to create something that maybe makes that just a little more difficult to discover the laws of structure. And so afterwards, there can be a question period about the ideas of structure that I'm just talking about. And the second advantage for me of and how I approach programmable instruments is what now I just call the listener's music. And this is a topic that's been buried really as forever until now. That's the factor that we as listeners, as human beings, when we hear, on the most simple case, two sine waves, two sine tones, we immediately create three more quite obvious tones in our ears. And in all orchestral music and all music, this happens, and it happens on a subliminal level, and it probably happens a lot really in good performances, that really sensitive performers and musicians are experiencing these maybe more vividly, and they're hearing them, and perhaps it explains one of the reasons that people might respond more to, it's one of the factors, not one of the reasons really, but one of the factors that might make a performance a little more moving or more special to people experience it, because the performer has really enhanced these things in whatever, from his piano playing or from the conductor, from the orchestra. And so now, with programmable technology, we can actually study these. Before I started first doing it with just oscillators, and of course that's very difficult, but now it's quite simple to make. I have a program that, unfortunately I brought some samples, but I can't show them on the... this is a different overhead. But I have a simple program that says, let me hear X. And maybe you can see, I can show you later. X would be this low tone right here, this low D. And here is a sample of just a few intervals. And so in my program, the person goes to... the computer and specifies one tone that he wants to examine as it appears as a first order difference tone, second or third order. And then the program sounds whatever intervals, if you wish to examine the third, fourth, fifth octave in whatever tuning system you might want. The program then sounds those intervals, and you can sit back and see how the tone quality of this D on this page differs from in the different intervals that you actually hear it. And so to me, this is really a very exciting feature to be able to have a program that does this. And it's very simple, but it enables me to really investigate these in a way that could never happen before. And then a second program enables me to enhance, to select from these combinations and reinforce and enhance these kind of tones that are in, let's say, a body of timbre or a body of music that I've created. I'm able to bring out certain tones this way from using this basic material. And besides these technical factors, I think it's really a curious issue because, as I said, this has been buried for years and years, and it's called psychoacoustic phenomena. The tones that we make as human responders, there really are response tones that we really stand or sit or whatever when we're experiencing music, and we are creating other tones that go along with the tones that are sounding. And I think in the early days, like in Vivaldi, you hear a lot of this in Vivaldi's music before, and also before notation really got off, people, the musicians probably gave a lot of attention to this. But then the notation started to become very important, and so it was only the notes that are sounding in the room, which I call the A tones, the acoustic tones. The B tones are here, the C tones are here, which I haven't discussed yet. But and so to me, it's so incredible because it seems like in all our music background, I don't know what we learn, really. It's as though when I was studying music, to learn about overtones, to learn about the physics of sound was like something only for scientists. It was, you were to psychoacousticians. And so what you, in my musical background, really what I was learning was now what samplers do, simply to rearrange the patterns and the figures of really other men's music and make a personalized form of this for myself. I wasn't learning anything about these very basic physics. And it's not that I wanted to know that much, but there are certain things that we exist in this world, and that for one thing, we are making these tones and we're totally unconscious of all of this. So in my work now, it's a major concern to try to compose consciously with these factors. And now is really the first time, actually, that it's possible. And that's because you're able to make a sufficient program to study these things in a conscious way, other than improvising and hearing nice tones and saying, oh, gee, this is good. This does something to me. You can really make a very objective music from this. And in my own work, I do work very objectively like that, and I work a lot with the second factor of our sense as human responders is what acousticians call pattern modulation or auditory beats in the brain. And as far as I know, it's not exactly clear what the research has not knowledge of what actually is sounding if it's some resonance in the neurons or not. But how this, the specific example of this is, if you take a tuning close to the fifth octave or fourth, and you arrange the beats so that they become very slow, and they're slowing down. There are many patterns, and I had brought an article from Scientific American that I was going to project of a study that was made binaurally, where people experience different shapes. Now, I had always done this when I began composing, but I had many strange names for these effects. So when I finally found some articles, they were very helpful to me because I knew that I was not listening too long, that actually there was fundamental research done, that people hear spirals, they hear curves, they hear various shapes. And this is very simple. In the Book of Rodier, he studies the monaural case. And monaurally, if you take the beat at the octave or the fifth or the fourth, you will hear the same shapes and the same patterns, which then tells the acousticians that this is not in the cochlea at all, like the other tones, which are mechanical and are called first-order effects. These are tones that we simply add to the music, from the vibration of our tympanic membrane and the spots on our ear. But the second-order effects are how we're able to extract information and actually make these patterns and these shapes. And without doing it consciously, in my own work, often begin this way because I'm able to make very, very nice melodies where they surprise me, and I do it through tuning and through this matter of taking simple intervals and hearing certain shapes. And in terms of our experiences, it really is very, very different because I have made recordings, a complete tape of really fundamentally the same timbres, the same music, really, except for a slight shift in what is phase or these shapes that I'm talking about from actual, whether the wave is very steady or whether it just moves a little bit. And these variations are all very different, how you experience them. They're very different. And this is something I suppose that will be eventually analyzed, how this happens. So I haven't yet made the study for this work, which would be simply stopping at each point and getting the patterns between the very fast beats and the very slow beat when the wave is almost touching and in tune. And the other factor is it's very interesting when you look at the octave in music. I didn't realize I had made some notes a long time ago, and I was actually going to show this because I looked at it the other day, and it's so beautiful. When it's only one octave apart, we have the tones we are sounding in our ear, let's say if it's two C's, middle C and two octaves above, we create a G and a C and an E. And then you take it one other octave and there's an A and a G and a G sharp. And it goes on like this. But when you get to the octave plus five, when it's very low and very high, all the tones we are making in our ear are also C. They're also, And I've actually experienced this in tuning, and this is something we can do really electronically that is, to me, quite exciting, that we can't do with instruments. We can actually make these tunings from the very bottom to the very top. And it's a very wonderful experience, and I really wonder, I don't know, I think it's because maybe suddenly at this point you get this sensation of like a pole, and it could be that it could be because finally at this point we're creating all the C's in response inside our ear, instead of when it's just one C to the next C, we have like three different tones, an E and a G and a B or whatever it is. So maybe it's just my personal, but I think it's very beautiful that that happens. And I think it's unfortunate that all of this has been so buried in as psychoacoustic phenomena and called that, and that we're, again, I get back to this thing that as musicians or composers we're supposed to walk around as kind of dummies, just writing these things and not knowing how they affect any of this. And so now maybe with programmable instruments this will become a more conscious factor in composition, and really experiences of this can be enhanced much more for the listener. So I don't know if any of you have any questions right now on that, or if you would rather wait till... how long have I been talking? I'm afraid. No, I just am concerned that maybe I'm talking too much. I didn't realize. How much more time do we have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Oh, okay. Well... then, all right, quickly, I'll say something then to get into the visual. I myself am very interested in what I think will happen soon. And so I try in some of my pieces where I'm able to make sets. It's like a little make-believe of something I think might be possible in maybe 5 or 6 years. I have a number of friends that are working in this area of virtual environments, it's called, and they work right now. I worked at MIT with Scott Fisher, who's now designed the helmet for the astronauts that enables you to wear this helmet, and you move your hand, and it's a remote, and it's as though you are in this three-dimensional space. Unfortunately, you have to wear the helmet, but we all dream of the time when actually such a virtual environment could be reconstructed in a room and could simulate, the first order of this would be to simulate another room, another place, another environment, like a photograph, but it would be a virtual construction of this, somehow like a three-dimensional projection. Now, this is a very interesting thing to think about as an artist, because I think the first level, of course, that will happen would be able to bring the Bruckner, the Stiftersaal space in here and reconstruct it and make this room. But I think even in this first order, there will be difficulties on the level of certain subliminal sounds that really are clues. They are like codes to how we recognize a place or a space. And even though, again, we are not conscious of these kind of tones in the environment, I learned this from actually my environmental work with the Boston Harbor. I didn't set out to say, oh, I want to find the resonant frequency or the tone, the hidden tones of these places, but I had it for 2.5 years, and suddenly I realized that there was there was a fundamental tone. There was a tone that was going on that was different than the tone in the space around where I was working, where I was born, where I grew up. I did a long work with John Cage, where Empty Words, Close Up is the name of the work, and the sound recordings I made for that were at Walden Pond. But these recordings were, to me, nothing. What I did was try to extract on the very subliminal level what the kind of undercurrent or the code of this space was, what I would hear on this most basic level. And I think for recreating the virtual environments in the future in terms of sound and in terms of images, there will be these kind of clues that will have to be worked out, and the knowledge will have to be inserted in the programming to make it a vivid or to make it a very real simulation. And there's a lot of work in this area because a lot of these things are still quite buried. I think in advertising, people are, of course, maybe more knowledgeable about this because they, I don't know if they really are, but at least they're interested because they want to manipulate people maybe into, you know, in order to sell their products. But it's for a different reason. And the second factor, I think, in the virtual environments that will become interesting, once these problems are solved, then if you have like the photograph made of the place, then the artist really has to begin to think of the ways of changing this, the ways of almost as a painter makes paintings of all different scenes doing strange things. Like I can imagine like a Dada period, all these strange things happening with these three-dimensional spaces. But this is after everyone will be very happy that you can have this simulation of this place and isn't this wonderful. Then the artist will come in and do whatever exotic or curious things, because it will help this situation. Because if we live in a world with all these kind of exact simulations, I think it will be, you know, it just will get very boring. And so in the future, I think this will preoccupy, it will be something that people will be involved with. Is, how about the time? Would you?
Some pictures.
Oh, I can just show a few. I just brought a few images here. These are from the work I described, the architectural stagings, and which were in two mini sound series. And these are some examples of some sets. Now you can imagine this. This is an actual stairway. In the room, and this was a duplicate of the couch of Freud with a rug, and the story had to do with these, and so I was using the, this is an emblem of the unconscious on that level. This is another shot. But my friend working in NASA said that you can likes to see these in the sense that they, if you could imagine these as not being a real stairway, but actually being a simulation. This is a real stairway. Oh, did I unplug this? It's not advancing. Oh, I did unplug it. Excuse me, my cable came unplugged. Oh, is it just here? Oh, thanks. And this is the same stairway. And in this, people walked into the space and the sound was staged. This was in San Francisco in the Cap Street, an installation in the Cap Street Gallery. And it is a house, a relatively modern kind of curved house that was designed by David Ireland for this gallery. And artists are invited for 6 weeks to work and 6 weeks to actually create a set. And that's a little child's chair. That's not really how it looked. It was taken by the photographer with the light. It's the same space. But I like to imagine these.
Oh, that's the same space, actually, but it's a different light which the photographer added.
But I like to imagine these not as, now this is not working, as simulations more than actual buildings, as though, think of them as though we had a simulated environment. And this is in the from an installation in the DID gallery in Berlin, where I did a four-part mini sound series over 4 weeks, and it was called The Music Rooms. And the idea of this work had to do with the power of music and this music that affects us, and we don't know why we like it. We don't know. I mean, we just have this music. So in the hallway, I used two elements. I used props from the German opera warehouse that were, and in the big storage room, some of them looked slightly abandoned. They were used in many productions, and they were props from Das Rheingold, and Salome, and swords from Siegfried, and the head of Johannes from the opera Salome, and a mirror from the opera Lulu. These were elements in the set. And then in the entrance, I had made four large murals of images and texts from the popular music press from England, New Music Express and Melody Maker. And to me, it's again this whole question examining of music, because there's really not a lot of difference between these newsprints from the pop music press and the images of the musicians and their slogans and their text as in the same kind of power symbols that were in the opera. And so I used the four rooms for this, and this was the entrance to one with the props from Das Rheingold, the gold. And this was the entrance way to the room. And this is another view of it. And this was in another room. This is a real music stand. The rest are projections. And there was a video installation in the room across the hall that had the twin image of this face. And it was in the room on the opposite side of the gallery on a very small monitor in this gold Wagner room. And this was a mirror. This is the mirror from Lula, which you can't see there.
And that's more lit. This is the head of Johannes. And this is a projection. And again, a twin face that was on the other side. And here's a bit of the pile of Siegfried, the swords, which can't be seen there. And this was the entranceway with the pop press about music. And then my music, the story of this, was intended to really provoke questions about this, these myths and all of this in music, and why it exists in the world, and why we have it, and why it's in every restaurant. And these are just some video installations where in Berlin, I have written a story about the work of various musicians. It takes place sometime in the future, and they have a laboratory. And of course, this is a wonderful laboratory. It's not like a like a normal. It's really a virtual environment where they would go in, and this would be an actual three-dimensional, and they have things come out of the floor, and they make all their sound researches and their visual researches in this really exotic place. And it's actually like a little bit that exists in medicine right now, when a neurosurgeon, instead of looking... Well, I realized this. I didn't know why I was so intrigued with making their laboratory, and then I realized what it was all about, because right now, to examine, for example, cell structures, you look through a microscope. But imagine if you actually walked into this same structure and it was around you, just as a neurosurgeon does not have to hold up an X-ray and examine the picture. He could actually walk in before the operation to a three-dimensional simulation and sort of practice, well, I'm going to move this and I'm going to change this, you know, in the person's brain that he's about to operate on. He would actually walk into this the whole geography of the brain rather than looking at it on a picture. So that's why I decided that's what I was really trying to make with this simulation of this laboratory, which involves these cells that they're studying and all sorts of exotic things, and also art, which is not just hanging on the walls but might come out of the floor. And so they're better able to study human beings, because I really feel myself that we probably are coming into an interesting time. First, there was the biological revolution, and then the computer revolution. And I think really the next really significant change is going to happen in the science of mind, that it will really be mind science, that finally these tools will enable us to know much more about our own sensitivity and our experiences as human beings. And there's real evidence for this in the sense of the founders of these fields, Francis Crick, who really is dedicated to Francis Crick, I mean the DNA, the founder of DNA research, who has been for years now in neuroscience and really studying perception. Okay, and the other figure, for example, Marvin Minsky in artificial intelligence, is much more involved in mind science than really hardware and that. And this, to develop this begins with these very basic studies in our perceiving. These are just some more. I think I should stop. The time, these are the twin characters. Okay, I think I should stop so that you can ask me questions about all this.
I feel sorry, but it's not possible to ask As I told you before, we don't have the time that far, but if you could pass over here for just some ideas about your work, please.
Sorry, I actually went over.
You know, there are always other people following, so
right.
We have to be a little bit economic with
yes,
time.
Sure.
Now should the next one start?
Right.
So, I think the crucial thing within your work, and which is very interesting and intriguing, is first the experimental character of your whole proposition, what is music today, and second, the interactive aspect. Could you define a bit more exact what you mean with interactivity?
Well, actually, the interaction I wanted to make for this particular festival, the concept we were not able to develop, and that was a telecommunication link with New York City. And the interaction was what I call now second-order interaction, because this is described in the catalog. It was not, I talk here, a telephone a link would have been made to a various, I was going to use the Times Square.